Good morning, everybody. Thanks for being here and for being in on time. I am Pierre Hocker. I'm the organizer of the conference and currently the president of the European Historical Economic Society. And I am happy to welcome you at the Paris School of Economics on behalf of Jean-Olivier Hérault, the director, who asked me to tell you that he regrets a lot not being able to be here today for health reason. He was very supportive of the organization of this conference. Maybe because the Paris School of Economics is relatively special among economics departments in having a quite strong economic history group, about 10 faculty members and almost as many young scholars. And also a place where we give a strong place to economic history in the master and PhD programs in economics with, for example, a compulsory class at the beginning of the master program for all students, which is taught by Thomas Piketty at the moment. This it is also special because it welcomes historians as members or as associate members of that economic history group, which is not so common, and which creates a strong link with history departments in general, and especially with a very large history department at the École des Hautes Études en Sciences Sociales, the School for Advanced Study in Social Sciences, which is one of the founding institutions of the Paris School of Economics, and to which most of the economic historians pertain. So we create an institutional relationship between economics and history there. And actually, when a few years ago, I was asked by a former president of the European Historical Economic Society, Giovanni Federico, to organize this conference, he told me that the trustees of the society wanted more French people and more historians to be on board of that society. He was convinced, and actually I am convinced too, that more cooperation between economists and historians is key to the development of economic history, that those two professions develop different and complementary skills. You know all these skills. We all try to manage as much as we can from all these skills. I mean, discovering and criticizing sources, understanding the context, modeling a problem, going deep into cases, building samples, either significative, representative, exhaustive, and trying to use methods, both qualitative and quantitative, to extract as much knowledge from this information. And so we all try to do that, but the two professions have clearly different focuses and they are complementary. So I could only accept this proposal. I did my best to advertise the conference among both economists and historians. And actually, I'm happy to have today more historians than is usual in these conferences. We more or less increased to about 25%, which is not negligible. And to have also, and because we have more historians, we also have a larger historical focus with more papers on ancient history, on medieval history, on early modern history than used to be the case. And I think today it is important to take all that time span when we look at economic history and when we teach economic history too. One way to attract people was to propose them to submit sessions. This is new to that conference. And it was quite successful since we accepted 12 sessions which were submitted as groups. I also wanted to increase the proportion of women in that conference, which we succeeded partly. The proportion is higher. It is still much below the mean, but it is increasing. We received a lot of submissions, about 300 submissions. We end up with 246 papers, which is a lot compared to previous conferences. It means you cannot even hope to see all the papers you would like to see. So that's a problem. The good thing is that you will be able to meet a very diverse group of people coming from 29 countries, from Europe, for the majority, but also from the Americas, from Africa, from Asia. We have, as in the European Historical Economic Society tradition, we have a lot of young scholars. That's a very good thing. That's the mark of an expanding field and an expanding society. About two-thirds of the conference participants are in their PhD program. That's a lot. And we all welcome them, and we ask them not to hesitate to discuss with the older people. As an older people, I really assure you that we are happy to know you and to meet you. The main function of the president of that society is to organize a conference, so that's what I tried to do. But I would have been completely unable to do it without the staff at the Paris School of Economics, especially Anya Le Fleur and Caroline Bauer, who are maybe there, no, maybe not, because they are working for you. I want to thank them in front of you. I must also thank Stefano Ungaro, who is a postdoc at the PSC, who is sitting here, who played a key role at the interface between the scientific and the administrative organization of the conference. I want also to thank the trustees, the past and the future president of the society, the Secretary General until next Saturday, Kerstin Enflo, who played a key role. And they were all very, very useful in the selection process, in the building of the program, and all the selections for diverse prizes and all that you will see in the next few days. So some more technical details, because we switched to the important part of that early morning. There is a group of students at the PSC who will help you for all questions you may have. They will help you in the conference room. They will help you for what you need. They wear white shirts and green ribbons, such as mine. So you can recognize them and you can ask them if you need something. They are here to help, but they are also here to learn. And so they will answer your questions, but please answer their questions too. They are young scholars, and they are here also to learn from you. The program is very dense, so I ask you to respect strictly the timeline. I know it's always complicated. You have half an hour per paper, which means usually 20 minutes for the presentation and 10 minutes for discussion. In any case, if you go beyond your 20 minutes, we will just shorten the discussion. And we would like for the last speaker of every session to act as a chairman, so that I will have the proper incentive to cut the former ones in order to be able to present his own paper. Even if you are a PhD student on the two people before you are very senior and important people, just don't hesitate. They know the rules. And even if they try, and they will try sometimes, you must ask them to stop. Various collective moments will facilitate discussions among you. The coffee breaks will all take place where you had the coffee breaks this morning, or in the interior. Actually, nobody entered the building, but there was also coffee there. So in the ground floor, there will be one just after the keynote speaks. There will be also water available on in the floors, in the two floors, the first floor and the second floor, where the conference rooms are. For environment reasons, we decided not to distribute small bottles of water, and we decided not to give you goodies and everything that are still so common in conferences. I think you understand. If you need something, just ask, and we will try to facilitate you what you need. The lunches will also take place on the ground floor. It is not possible for hygienic reasons to have the buffet themselves outside, but you can bring something outside and have lunch on the tables, which are either in the garden or around the place. So this afternoon there is a dissertation session where three recent PhD compete for the dissertation prize. It will take place at 1:30, and it will be take place here. Please be there and be there on time. There were many candidates. There were many excellent dissertations submitted. It was really a struggle to choose three among these 30 ones. And I can guarantee it will be interesting. The prize itself will be delivered tonight at the cocktail party that will start at 6:30 until about 8 or 8:30. Tomorrow, the general meeting of the society will take place in this room at 6. So you are all members, since being member of the society was a requirement to be able to register. So you can participate, and you are very welcome. The departure to the gala dinner will take place at 6:45, so you are sure that the meeting won't be long. And buses will bring those of you who registered for the gala dinner at 6:45 right here in along the street there. The dinner will be on the Seine River on a boat. I think I mentioned most important things. So I will switch now to the really important thing of this morning, which is to introduce the our keynote speaker, Francesca Trivelato. Well, actually, the most important privilege of the president is to choose the keynote speaker. I wanted that choice to clearly signify orientations I consider important for economic history, looking for large spaces, not country-specific or region-specific problems, looking for broad time periods, including the early modern period, reintegrating business history, and opening cooperations with any sort of historians, including cultural and political historians. Francesca is a professor at the Institute of Advanced Study in Princeton, where she recently moved from Yale. Her research deals with early modern economic and cultural history of Europe. You probably all know her famous book, The Familiarity of Strangers, on the Sephardic diaspora, on the cross-cultural trade in the early modern period, which was published in 2009 and translated in various languages. She edited important books. Her last book, The Promise and Period of Credit, has just been published by Princeton. It studies its start from a forgotten legend about Jews and finance that tells us a lot about the making of European commercial society. So at a time when the interactions between cultural studies and economics are of interest from even economic theorists, I'm sure we will learn a lot from her. Francesca is also interested in historiography, maybe a result of Italian training. I recommend her paper in business history and business history of the pre-industrial world in historical methods. So she will be happy to discuss with you at the end of her speech. So She's a very deep and productive scholar. We are very happy to have her here. Thank you again for coming, and the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. I am extremely honored to be here, and I admit I'm also a bit surprised. Some of you will also be surprised. I think Pierre Cyril remarks both assuage my anxieties, but also explain my sense of surprise. The information online is not complete, but from what I was able to gather, I am the first person to open this conference who has a PhD in history rather than economics. I'm also the first woman, which may be of secondary importance, but from you said, not completely irrelevant. Some of you have been with the European Historical Economics Society since its inceptions, and many others, I'm sure, have read the account that is posted on its website, written by the late Carl Gunnar Persons, about how the society came into being and about its first 10 years of institutional and intellectual life. And as I've tried to summarize the points that Persons makes, the ambitious and interconnected goals of the society that the society sets for itself from its starts were to promote cleometrics, or analytical economic history as they're called, in the piece among European economic historians by making the EHES, by marking the EHES distance from the dominance of the North American cleometric society, but also without alienating those European economic historians who use more traditional methods, and all the more so to promote the study of continental European economic history, which was one of Persons' own areas of interest. Now, I use the word European in the way in which Persons use it, which, given how global the trajectories of our academic lives have been, may call for some reflections. But the point here is that each one of these goals is a big challenge in of itself, and to keep them all together in the current academic landscape, it's certainly not a given. So I would like to situate my remarks against this background, because I think that conferences like this one are ideal opportunities to discuss not only the findings of our individual and collective projects, but also how we do economic history and what it means that we prefer one method, one approach over another. In North America, where I have been based for now almost two decades, historians have all but deserted the Economic History Association meetings. Meanwhile, last year in Boston, the World Economic History Conference, I had the distinctive impression that there were sessions with economists and sessions with historians, which hopefully won't happen when the same conference meets here in Paris in 2 years, but I think it tells a lot about what the field is today. And I think economic history may be unique in the academic world insofar as the field, in its broadest sense, uses the same label, economic history, to refer to what are, in fact, separate and increasing divergent joint job markets and tenure processes. I'm curious about your experience. I think I know three individuals in North America who have voting rights in both history and economics departments. One has retired, and their other two will retire soon. So I'm sure there are more, but not many. And that, I think, tells quite a lot. So I think, as Pierre Cyril was hinting at, one of the questions that some of us have is where does the dialogue can productive take place? And is there still a point in trying to engender some convergence? And here I want to put a plug for a brand new journal that will appear, or the first issue will appear in a few months. I recently joined Marc Flandreau and Julia Ott as one of the co-editors. And as the subtitle says it, we're hoping to have contributions from across the spectrum of those of you who think of themselves as economic historians. So what I would like to do very rapidly this morning are three things. One is to give a very brief overview of the field with particular reference to the place of pre-industrial, particularly continental Europe, in it. Second, to think about criteria we may want to use to map the major trends in how historians and economists study pre-industrial continental Europe, and then give two examples from my own work about how I approach the field. So the first part, we can start, I think, from a shared commiseration by saying that economic history is marginal to both economics and history department. That doesn't mean, you know, necessarily that, you know, we're all in the same boat, but there's something to be said about the positions in which we're all in. But from this point of commonality, then there are opposite strategies by which we legitimize what we do with our respective colleagues. And in this respect, in fact, economic history has been diverged between the trends in history and economics department. Fewer than 4% of the articles published in the top four econ journals use the Journal of Economic Literature code economic history. A recent effort to revert this tendency is the collective volume, An Economist's Guide to Economic History, which is a collection of high-caliber short chapters addressed primarily to graduate students in economics. And overall, the volume argues for the importance of studying economic history, as I understand it, on two grounds. On the ground that the past weighs on the present and teaches lessons that matter to policymakers, and that is therefore to get the past right. Now, both statements are undeniably true. The question is whether in practice, the need to draw lessons from the past can sometimes conflict with the need to get the past right. And that is a problem that concerns economists and historians to the same extent. But I've emphasized the word lessons, and I will return to it because you'll see that it's a recurring theme in a number of works. Now, in any case, I think that today there is little ambiguity about the type of economic history that is most valued by economists, and there's a session devoted to this topic this afternoon in which Christopher Colvin, one of the editors, is also presenting. Here I'm drawing from a study by Robert Margot, who has shown that over time, the careers of the most successful economic historians with a PhD in economics have been defined more and more by their number of publications in the top five econ journals. There are, fortunately, exceptions, but that is the aggregate trend. Margot has also documented the increasing frequency with which econometrics language appear in relevant journal. And you can see here the Journal of Economic History. Where's my pointer? Well, you see the blue dotted, the bottom dotted line is the Journal of Economic History. The very same trends are also documented in a table rather than a graph by a distinguished scholar Bill Sewell, who is by training, I mean, he teaches in a political science department, but I think is a broadly, very broad historian in many ways, who in a piece on in the History and Theory Journal documented the increased use of statistical tables and mathematical languages in the Journal of Economic History. Now, on the part of historians, what is the response to these trends? One rare, but in my view, very important response has been by two, in fact, French authors in this recently translated beautiful book, The Quantitative Methods in the Humanities by Claire Mercier and Claire Zalk. Probably not a coincidence that they are French. Is an attempt to equip humanists with at least the ability to consume passively some degree of econometrics, but more importantly, to equip humanists with the idea of how creatively how quantitative methods can improve their own work and make their own goals and their own qualitative research more creative. And so it's really an interesting book in terms of the kind of intellectual puzzles that can be addressed with different approaches that have become more and more marginal, particularly within North American history departments. Now, as I said, this is not the most frequent response by humanists and by historians. More prevalent response by historians to the increased use of econometrics in economic history is one of defiance and outright rejection. This has been the case for one of the most influential trends in history departments in recent years, at least in North America, the so-called history of capitalism, which was featured in the New York Times in 2013. It's not often that history departments make the New York Times, so a lot of people were very happy. The article described how a certain number of courses titled History of Capitalism had boosted enrollments after the 2008 global recessions. Most recently, some of you have been following, there's a new feature of the New York Times called 1619 that is somewhat inspired by this idea. Now, the conclusion, I mean, the overall approach of this trend is generally averse to economics. It studies the relationship between slavery and capitalism in North America, particularly in the United States. The focus is primarily after 1800, and mostly, as I said, on the United States. There are some younger PhDs who do a little bit more global history, but the focus is still predominantly North America. So here we may have a paradoxical situation. I hope it's not the case. It's a bit too early to sound like a Cassandra, but we may be not too distant from the 1970s when the debacle of the time on the cross, when in the 1970s, when economic history was still quite strong in history department, and the relationship between the intellectual exchanges between economists and historians clashed over the publication of Times on the Cross. Now that economic history has returned to historian departments, I hope we're not going toward a new nadir of intellectual cooperations between economists and historians. So some of the questions I have for the second part and the third part of my talk is, which kind of cooperation is there and can exist, particularly for the work that focuses on the period before 1800, about which I know a little more. Now here, the commonality of, feeling of commiserating in our marginality is exponential, since the interest, we're really on the periphery of economic history. With my colleague Oscar Hendelblum from Utrecht University, we tabulated the distribution of articles in Economic History Journal, stands for the Journal of Economic History and the Economic History Review and Business History, or the business is Business History Review and Economy and Society. And you can see that the interest in the pre-1800 period is obviously abysmal among business historian and peripheral among economic historians. This is naturally more pronounced in the Journal of Economic History, which is the North American journal. The Economic History Review has a very long tradition of publishing medieval and early modern contributions. The place of continental Europe as opposed to England, and after 1707, Great Britain in economic history of pre-industrial Europe is also even sort of more here more peripheral, and is particularly accentuated in the Journal of Economic History for obvious reasons. To make the point easier, these are the word clouds for the economic history journals and the business history journals. So just to summarize what I've been saying so far, I think this nestling dolls picture says more or less what I wanted to say about the place of economic history in economics department, about the place of the pre-industrial period in economic history, and the place of pre-industrial continental Europe in economic history. Obviously, there are other regions and periods of the world that are even more neglected, and others are doing very important work to bring them to mainstream attention. Now, why is pre-industrial Europe interesting, and how do we study? Here, at the broadest level, I would venture to say that whether implicitly or explicitly, both historians and economists find pre-industrial Europe interesting for the same reason. And because there's a singular temporal convergence that marks the history of the West, if we want to use this expression. And the singular temporal coincidence is that the Industrial Revolution in Britain unfolded roughly at the same time as political revolutions were taking place in North America with the creation of the United States and in France. For all their differences in British, French, and American past to industrialization and democracy, this temporal coincidence makes it hard to separate economic analysis from political and cultural analysis. And even when we don't say it explicitly, that is what is we are all fundamentally grappling with. So if I wish to map the most significant trends in economic history of pre-industrial Europe, here I don't have any quantitative evidence. So it's particularly my own hunch, if you wish. I've tried to think about three classification criteria in order to map the literature. One is a most simple one is to categorize historians and economists and divide them between those who emphasize continuity and those who stress discontinuity. But most of those who work on early modern Europe, not all, most of them are gradualists, are interested in how the Industrial Revolution unfolded over time. And I will go so far as to suggest that even Pomerant's Great Divergence has a gradualist element, because if the location of coal is contingent, the main cause of the British Industrial Revolution, according to Pomerant's, being slavery and the Caribbean plantations, those are the outcome of at least two centuries of British involvement in the Atlantic. So in some ways, the most discontinuous of all our literature contains a grain of gradualism. Another classification criterion would be to identify a number of causation lines that scholars emphasize in order to think about what produced the beginning of economic growth in pre-industrial Europe. Now here I have identified five different lines of causations. But the problem is that these lines of causations, when you look closely, are in fact more blurred than one might think. This is particularly true when we think about the relationship between those who defend political and legal institutions as the primary cause of economic growth versus those who argue for the importance of human capital, technology, and religion. In his 1971 Nobel Prize lecture, Kuznets listed six characteristics of modern economic growth, one being the institutional and ideological adjustments that technological change requires. And his primary examples of those adjustments were urbanization and secularization. Now, this is obviously, these are the standard components of modernization theory that was prevalent at the time. And secularization is a most controversial term among historians. Most historians today would not embrace it, but it still holds sway in some quarters. Here, Margaret Jacob, a historian at UCLA, and Joel Mokyr, an economist, although one of the three with joint appointments and voting rights in two departments at Northwestern, have found common cause in their focus on England and the United Provinces and on thinking about secularism and the Enlightenment. There's also work among some economists on the so-called religious determinants of economic performance, Reformation and the printing press, religious minorities in the Muslim empires of the Middle East. This and the so-called cultural persistence literature is where I think you'll find the least sympathetic audience among historians for whom culture is not a measurable indicator. Going back to the lines of causations, most famous 1989 North Weingans' Constitution and Commitment, the most cited article ever published in the Journal of Economic History, there's an effort to separate political institutions from larger cultural trends, but in some ways the geotemporal location of the English financial revolutions inscribes the story in a rather traditional arc, and that is why there's a kind of implicit overlap between culture and institutions in that story that then echoes in the recent successful Why Nation Fails. Now elsewhere, Robinson and their colleague at MIT, Johnson, expanded the analysis of the role of early modern political institutions to various regions colonized by the Europeans. And here they mix environmental and institutional lines of causation by linking the type of European institutions that were developed in different regions of the world to the level of mortality that European colonizers experience in that region. So here again, there's an attempt to make an emphasis on institution, but you cannot separate it from environmental conditions. And environmental history has a very long and distinguished traditions among historians. We're in Paris, so although it's not often a point of reference for Anglophone environmental historians, one has to remember that first published in French in 1949 was Fernand Braudel, La Méditerranée, The Mediterranean and the Mediterranean World, which is a really, in my views, an argument as a clear definition of what pre-industrial period is. It's not a geodeterministic story, but in Braudel's definition, the longue durée, it's not a lot of centuries. It is a particular period that ends with the Industrial Revolution when human society's ability to alter the rhythm created by the environment is limited. And that's a very important point for economic historians because of the degree to which the environment built constraints on how economic, legal, and political institutions can alter market relations. The real breakthrough, particularly in the Anglophone world, came with a publication, by Alfred Crosby, the Columbian Exchange, and then this very provocative, brilliant, though very controversial book, Ecological Imperialism, and elements of environmental constraints have then been incorporated even by the most established political historians, as Sir John Eliot, in one of his last books. Now, returning to Pomerance, I think that's where you see a mixture of environmental lines of causations, because obviously, as I said before, one of his major points is that the location of coal mines in England was much more favorable to industrialization than the location of coal mines in China. But there's also his other lines of causation, which is violence, that is colonial plantations and cash crops. So here again, there's not a neat single lines of causations. Now, citing Pomerance bring me to the third way in which we could classify trends in the study of pre-industrial Europe, which would be to distinguish between approaches that integrate micro and macro scales of analysis and those approaches that focus on macroeconomic indicators such as GDP, consumer price indexes, living standards, and so forth. And here, my question, it's a genuine question to this audience because I am, if you wish, a kind of a participant observant to this growing field, is whether the great visibility that the scholarship on GDPs has acquired, particularly with the inclusion of non-Western areas, China and South Asia, has reached a degree of dominance in the field or not. And then, as Pierre Cyril said, there are a number of young scholars in this conference, and I would be particularly curious to hear from you, how do you feel, whether this is the driving agenda collectively or not. Now, historians naturally gravitate more toward the blending of micro and macro, and they regularly read works by scholars such as Pomerance and Mokyr, and my impression is that they don't read economists in other areas which are nonetheless of growing interest among traditional historians. One that I'm particularly familiar with is that of commerce and credit. And that's where there's a very dynamic scholarship that blends micro and macro among economists. And being in this building, I cannot but cite two very important books conceived upstairs on the fifth floor, if I'm not mistaken, by Gilles Postel-Vinet and his collaborators, Philip Hoffman and Jean-Laurent Rosenthal, who have used enormous data gathered from notarial archives in Paris and across France to study credit. And there are other scholars who also are economists who work on pre-modern credit. Nathan Sussman, who's together with some of his co-authors presenting tomorrow. But my impression is that historians don't read this particular work as much. As I said, it's an impression. Now, traditionally, the lack of ready-made serial data has been a major reason for the low level of interest in pre-industrial period among economists. This has been reversed by the availability of GDP data first assembled by Angus Madison and then constantly updated as we go. There was a recent working papers I downloaded on Renaissance Tuscany by Jan Leuten, Van Zijden and collaborators, which I haven't even read because I downloaded it on the way here. And here, I think there's another paradox that on the one hand, economic historians began to gravitate toward GDP at about the same time as economists had begun to express very serious reservations about this index. And at the same time, because of these reservations, because of the skepticism by their own colleagues, economic historians in econ department have pushed ahead, and this has led them to build more and new, more robust data set. So it's actually a productive paradox, probably. For historians, this body of scholarship is the one that raises the most eyebrows because of the simplifications and omissions that it intakes. But criticisms have not come only from historians. In fact, a number of economists have been very critical of this literature, one of them being Jane Humphreys and her collaborators, who have taken issues with Robert Allen's theses about high wages and British industrializations, arguing that those data do not include data from children and women's work, which would considerably lower the average wages that Allen and collaborator compiled. More recently, in a very deeply researched book on the market regulation of bread prices in the United Provinces after 1590, Jan de Vries criticized the use of both income-based GDP estimates and consumption baskets for the purpose of long-term comparisons. Like Humphreys, though for very different reasons, he believes that male daily wages are not an appropriate reference to calculate annual households. He shows that although white bread was more expensive, and high, in part because high taxes, in his argument, families decided to work harder in order to continue, you know, to improve their purchasing power and continue to be able to eat white bread. So that's one of the first lessons he draws from this story. And again, there's a session tomorrow afternoon at 4:30 on wages that I'm sure will reassess this theme with much greater depth than I'm able to do here. Another topical trend perhaps nowhere as much as in this building, is the study of wealth and income inequality. Now, this trend has been slow to reach the pre-industrial period. Again, there's one session tomorrow morning about it. And a recent volume has put this topic on the map. This is a volume by Guido Alfani and Matteo Di Tullio that is very innovative in more than one respect. First, it provides new data from land, taxation on land in the mainland territories of the Venetian Republic between 1500 and 1800, and links these data to existing fiscal regimes, arguing that fiscal regimes exacerbated wealth inequality. Second, and it's a point that is very important for those of us who are interested in the pre-industrial period, it insists on the need to consider the cultural perceptions of inequality. The authors reminds us that, of course, egalitarianism was not a collective ideal in pre-industrial Europe, and economic stratification was both legally and socially sanctioned. The existence of the poor was something that was not just taken for granted, but almost demanded by the Counter-Reformation and the concept of society. Now, even Alfani and Di Tullio's sophisticated cultural analysis of inequality, however, assumed a kind of fixed stratification of old regime societies that I think gives us an exceedingly ossified image. And this is one of the issues that I try to address in my own work, and that allows me to transition to my last part with bits of research that I conducted in the past and that I am in the process of working on. So when I studied wages, I took issues with the assumption that average daily wages were the important topic. In fact, I worked precisely on the dispersion of wages, a topic that I think has been unjustly overlooked. So this is a graph of the wages received by masters and journeymen in the glass furnaces of Murano during the 17th century. And in the central area, you see that there is a large band of wages that are received by both masters and journeymen. That is that the hierarchy in the guild is not the sole determinants for compensation. And that is the same for those who were paid weekly rather than by the day. And the reason for this overlap in my interpretation is that there were two concepts of justice at the time that governed the entire social system and the conception of what once was owed. And the two concepts of justice, which go back to Aristotle's, are distributive justice, that's not what it's meant today. It's not redistributive, which is the idea according to which people are born different, society is organized by orders, and there's some degree of inequality that is just. But at the same time, there's also a pre-modern concept of commutative justice, that is that you're owed what you produce. And so in this the point here, this is a famous frescoes from Siena, just before the Black Death, Piero Lorenzetti. This is a fresco of the good government. It was supposed to be seen by all foreign ambassadors as they walked into the communal building. And they saw the figure of justice who held two scales. And the two scales, which are on equal footing, hold both commutative and distributive justice. And two threads, this is not very visible, but there are two threads coming out from each of the two scales. This is the allegory of Concord, who passes both threads to these men who are the counselors of the Republic of Siena, meaning that the good government, which is obviously a male oligarchical government, is supposed to instantiate both commutative and distributive justice. To map these two concepts very concretely, distributive justice is one that recognizes that masters are superior to journeymen by definition, while commutative justice is the individual justice of the single worker and his productivity. So the need to balance hierarchy and productivity is what account for this system. Once after 1660, a lot of foreign competition put strains on the glass manufacturers of Murano. The government of the city and the guild created a new collective agreement whereby only those who were licensed masters received a special privilege, the privilege of being paid an unemployment subsidy in case at the beginning of the working season there was not employment for them. So the principle of distributive justice gave them a privilege that was commensurate with their position on the social hierarchy, that and did not give that privilege to journeymen who were left to the individual negotiations. That had some effect on the level of wages that became somewhat less dispersed, and overall, as you can see here, the master's wages decreased, but also gave security of a considerable subsidy to those who were not employed. The same did not happen for journeymen who were instead left to individual negotiations. So the lessons that I draw from this particular case studies was one specifically about what was my concern at the time, the relationship between technological innovation and guilds, which in the 1990s was a very hot topic about which economists and historians had the views of economists and historians don't necessarily map by discipline. That's an interesting debate in which the views of whether guilds were favorable or obstructed technological change did not map exactly on whether you were a historian or an economist. But here I argued that individual productivity was valued alongside guild hierarchy, and that as long as there was, as long as Murano maintained a position of leadership within the European glass industry, in fact, the guilds were not obstructing individual productivity. And in other areas of the work I did on technological innovations, in order to become a master, you had to be born in Venice, and a lot of these journeymen could have never become masters because they were not born in Venice, and so they were paid more because they were actually able to do what is clearly master-like work, but they could never progress in their hierarchy. The very broader lessons that I drew is that as we think of the pre-industrial period, neither class conflict nor fixed guild hierarchies are good analytical frameworks, but rather we need to think about the coexistence of individual contract and status as wage determinants. And so the situation in which the individual negotiations of wages allowed opportunities for some, but then regulation sometimes predetermined who were the winners and the losers. The second example comes from work that is very much in progress, and it is about the relationship between enterprise form and economic organization. Now, again, to return to Braudel, a lot of historians emphasize the constraints that technology exerted on information systems in the pre-modern period. Obviously, it took a long time to traverse oceans, although it's kind of astounding how far merchants traveled and worked. But that's one of the reasons why historians tend to emphasize the role of in-group networks in order to explain how merchants protected themselves from the insecurities of trade. Much less work is done on how information was constructed locally as opposed to over very large distances. There's some work on so-called economic journalism that argues that the diffusion of the printing press and things like the printing of price sheets and currency exchange lists and so forth created some degree of homogenization. Although one has to remember that in pre-industrial period, information never traveled faster than human beings. There's some attempts, things like lighthouses or pigeons, traveling pigeons, but fundamentally, whether it's manuscript or printed, you still have to give your piece of paper to somebody, put it on a ship, on board of a ship, on the back of a donkey, or somewhere. Now, thinking about how individual reputation works, that's the most, I think that's the most interesting, as far as I'm concerned, part of the information system in this period, because many aspects of one's own individual place in societies are captured by what we called reputation. There's an element of legal status, there's an element of economic performance. There are no credit ratings, no social credit ratings yet, although there are forms of very tight social control. So I was drawn to Florence, where the state archives houses what I believe is the longest series of limited partnership contracts registered in pre-industrial Europe. There are over 20 volumes that summarize limited partnership contracts dating from 1445 to 1808. And I would say that today there still is a large assumption that there is a relationship between business organization and economic growth. This assumption is largely taken for granted, whereby general partnerships are atavistic and limited partnerships are more modern. In fact, this assumption is taken for granted to the extent that there is much more literature about when and where limited partnership first emerged and how they diffused, rather than studies about how they, like who operated it and who used them and for what purposes. Now, my preliminary analysis, which is still ongoing, in Florence, there's a very limited menu of enterprise forms, and that is true for most of pre-industrial Europe. The focus on the corporation is really a bit of a misnomer. Corporations are a really marginal form of business organization in pre-industrial Europe. So you can have you can be a sole proprietor, you can have a general partnership, you can go to a notary and make an agreement about whatever you want in Tuscany, and in fact, from secondary literature in most of Europe, people do not do it. There is something akin to a holding company, which is how the Medici Bank was organized, that after from the 1500 onwards is quite rare in Florence, in Tuscany. So my sobering conclusion, preliminary but almost ironic, I'm telling myself, is that of these, the limited partnership was never a preferred mode of organization in early modern Tuscany. Of the about 5,000 of them were registered, which makes for about 12 on average per year, which is very, very few. And about half of them you had operated in Florence and other cities. Everywhere, in fact. Not only the number of limited partnerships was very few. Here you see on average for the city of Florence about 7, Livorno being in this period, the largest European Mediterranean commercial hub together with Marseille and Venice. Very few limited partnerships. There's also no particular way of mapping the number of limited partnership onto what we know of the overall economic trends in the city. When we looked at the duration of these particular partnerships, we see that they do not differ in any substantial way from what we know from case studies, because about general partnership, nowhere in pre-modern Europe do we have registers that allow us, sources that allow us to have the universal reference for all partnerships, because general partnerships registered between merchants in private forms are recognized by all tribunals. So private papers can be brought to court. Most general partnerships are sealed privately, sometimes through marriage alliances. So we don't have a universal reference, but we have a sense for most cities of how many merchants are operating. So we know that these limited partnerships are very, very few. And also we know there is the famous Buddenbrook syndrome, pre-modern partnerships did not last very long. Bankruptcies were very frequent. And here we see that limited partnerships do not last much longer. They also do not bring about a large number of investors. General partners and limited partners are small, as small as we know from case studies most general partnerships are. And contrary to some 19th century reformers' claim that limited partnership can allow people with talent and no money, even women, it doesn't seem to have worked. So I came to this topic by studying Livorno, where Jewish merchants are the largest business community. They do not live in a ghetto. They're highly assimilated. And yet we find that in spite of the absence of any legislation forbidding Christians from having joint limited partnerships with Jews, there are very few of such partnerships, in fact, three as far as I can tell. So this empirical research rubs against what I think is still the prevalent view that, as summarized here by Doug North, the transformation of uncertainty into risk, that the study of limited partnerships is informed by the genealogical emphasis on the origins, the commenda, regardless of his origins, then in the hands of the Italians, become the English regulated company, and finally the joint stock company, and provides an evolutionary story. So I'm arguing against this evolutionary story because, in fact, we don't know how these limited partnerships actually worked. And I also rub against the central tenet of North, according to which in Southern Europe, property rights are weak. In Southern Europe, thanks to the commercial revolution of the late Middle Ages, property rights are very strong, but clearly property rights alone did not perform magic. And there's a lot of other elements in the market, including the asymmetry of information between investors, passive and active investors, and questions of cultural perception and social and legal barriers within the community that influence the choices of borrowers and debtors. So let me conclude just to say that by way of this very brief overview and a couple of examples, I have tried to show the continued relevance both historically and historiographically of pre-industrial Europe for how we do economic history. I mostly wanted to emphasize the importance of studying how markets work regardless of when and where modern economic growth began. And in this respect, I think that there are three distinctive characteristics of pre modern European societies that make the study of pre-modern markets extremely interesting as an intellectual puzzle. European societies before 1800 and even after 1800, but that's another story, were unequal by design. They were justly unequal according to their participants. And therefore, the legal status and the social status that people had outside of the market cannot be disentangled from the way in which they operated on the market. And yet the market eroded those legal statuses. As Braudel has emphasized, the technology evolved and was able to alter human ability to, for example, cross oceans. Though, for example, until the steamship was invented, it was impossible to cross the Indian Ocean outside of the monsoon seasons. So there are a lot of examples in which the timing of nature determined the timing of exchange. And lastly, information asymmetry was staggering in spite of progresses brought about by commercial law, by naval technology, and so forth. I don't think I need to stress the echoes of these theme have in our contemporary moment with its disillusionment for some of the promises of the equalizing forces of global capitalism. I just want to stress how I, in my view, in order to understand pre-modern European markets, we need to expand both our empirical research and the methods we use to do economic history. Thank you.